often wearily, completing one another's sentences. Mostly Raquel did the talking, the custodial job being too banal for Rob to bother getting into, the lab work too complicated. She was stressed about having skipped a year, the financial and social task that lay ahead, the fact that she would be finishing school alone since most of her friends had left and were already beginning their lives. Rob would calmly tell her to put her head down and do what she needed to do to get through it. He would tell her that he was her friend. She could rely on him. Perhaps in all of his various and diverse social circles, the stoners, the scientists, the burger boys, he was most comfortable in this role, sitting across from a female friend and passively permitting her to depend on him, to transfer her anxieties onto his shoulders the way his own mother rarely let him do. He was skilled at making a woman feel taken care of, and this knack had caused trouble before. Senior year, he'd been at the house Daniela Pierce shared with her boyfriend Lamar. She was making dinner and had trouble opening a jar. She brought it to the living room where Rob and Lamar were talking and gave the jar to Rob. He opened it easily and assured her that she must have already loosened it up for him. They had a nice dinner. Daniela had become heavily involved in social work in the New Haven community, particularly in helping teenagers with police records finish high school, and Rob would listen to her catalog, the alarming statistics, for hours. After dinner, Rob left, which was when Lamar erupted at her with genuine outrage. "What did you give him the jar for?" "Excuse me?" Daniela asked. "The jar. You gave it to Rob to open it. I live here. I'm your man. I should have opened the jar." "That's ridiculous," she replied. But even then, she began thinking about how instinctively she had given Rob the husband's task. "You're crazy." The intensity of the interaction, the visceral anger Rob was able to inspire in another man, amazed her. If Rob was aware of the effect he could have, he didn't show it. He did spend much of his time with women who were involved with others. He did encourage them to open up to him in ways they never would to their actual boyfriends. Sometimes he would do this in the presence of those boyfriends. He didn't seem to think twice about it. And he'd never made advances on a married woman. In exchange, these women braided his hair for him, watched kung fu movies with him, and cooked for him. Rob would never pass up a free meal. Generally, aside from a few episodes similar to the one with Lamar that could be brushed off as overreaction, he considered himself cool with the boyfriends. By all appearances, he remained ignorant of the fact that, over time, an increasing number of men, primarily black, began talking behind his back, calling him arrogant, calling him cheap, calling him a nigger. "There are niggers and there are brothers," Rob had told me once, lightly. He was referring to a song that was so peppered with the word that it made me fidget. Simply hearing the N-word set off all sorts of alarm bells in a white guy, though Rob was grinning and clearly enjoying this teachable moment. I knew I had to be careful about everything, from my responses to my expressions to my hand gestures. Under no circumstances could I say the word myself, nor could I act as though I understood anything Rob said regarding the word. I replied with the ponderous, "Huh." "Niggers just like to start shit," he said. "They don't value human interaction, let alone human life. They're just stupid, period. They walk around trying to act hard, trying to be bangers." In Newark parlance, bangers was pronounced as two separate syllables, bangers. "That's all a nigger cares about, acting hard, fronting." "What about the brothers?" I asked. This word felt much safer. "A brother's like me. He just wants to take care of his own and chill." And during the summer and fall after graduation, that was pretty much what Rob Peace did. And even though he drove down to Newark every weekend, Jackie was not pleased. The last 4 years had been the hardest of her life. She'd worked, she'd taken care of her ailing parents, she'd spent money as fast as she'd earned it, on only the essentials. For the first time in her life, she'd been alone. The struggle that felt inseparable from the place and circumstances of her birth was primarily leavened by company. The big families, the stoop culture, the social gatherings outside liquor stores. But Jackie wasn't like Skeet. She rarely ventured beyond the daily rhythms of home and work. The only leisure she allowed herself was the occasional trip to Atlantic City, where she played slots, sitting alone in a bank of strangers, pulling that crank again and again until the skin of her hand began to dry out and crack. If she couldn't find a room for less than $30, she would drive him there and then drive home. Otherwise, during her relatively few free hours, she sat on the porch and smoked. Frances would be inside watching TV hooked to her oxygen tank, and Horace would be shuffling around, Jackie would sink deep into the Adirondack chair facing the vacant lot across the street, maybe exchanging a few words with the passing neighbor while projecting her preference for silent solitude. She would think mainly of Rob at Yale. Landing her son at such a place had been her life's primary goal, and yet the essence of that place had always escaped her. Yale, to her, was a corridor between stations, not a place with a pulse. She didn't care much about the dynamics of living there, and when Rob visited during college, he spoke of those dynamics, hardly at all. Lacking the information necessary to ponder what he was doing in New Haven, she thought instead of what he would be doing when he left. From what she could tell, after graduation, he wasn't doing much. She figured that the lab work was good for him, but the only path it laid out would be toward more school, and if there was going to be more of that, she didn't understand why he seemed reluctant to get his education over with and settle down. Victor, to her, set the example. He'd gone to school in order to learn to fly, and now he was doing just that in the Air Force Reserve. The only goal her son seemed to talk about was Rio. He appeared to have some vague plan of establishing a scientific career there. Jackie didn't know much about Rio, but she knew that the city was famous for parties, drugs, samba, poverty, robberies, and not science. Each time he'd left for New Haven, she would find a few $100 in cash on the counter, the same spot he'd once left $4 or $5. She'd never asked for money. She didn't depend on it, though it certainly helped. She chose not to wonder where it came from, because he never left more than he seemed able to afford from his lab work. This was easy to do. And yet, something about these bills, maybe the haughty way he fingered them out from a roll of cash like a real operator, worried her. She was also worried about him leaving the house when he was home. She hadn't experienced this anxiety since he'd been a boy, and even then she hadn't worried much, because he'd usually been with his father or with friends to look out for him. During Rob's college years, as Jackie watched from her perch on her porch, a sea change had overtaken the surrounding blocks in the form of gang violence. When Rob had left for college in 1998, there had been a few loose formations that could have been construed as gangs, mostly brought together by geographical proximity. Young men had always been territorial about their neighborhoods and their drugs, and their resultant conflicts had caused most of the violence in Newark during the first 2 decades of Rob's life. But those threats had also been relatively easy to navigate. You knew where the boundaries were, you knew where the dealing centers were, and you steered clear. Or else you made sure you knew the right people. You Newark-proofed. But when Rob graduated from Yale in 2002, there were more than 100 gangs operating in Essex County, and these gangs, these terrible loyalties, were based on people rather than places. People were more dangerous, less predictable, less clearly demarcated. The sex, money, murder bloods, the nine tray bloods, the G-shine gangster killer bloods, the Grape Street Crips, the Five Deuce Hoover Crips, the Double I Set Bloods, the Roland 60s Crips, the Fruit Town Brims, the Latin Kings, Nieta, the Pagans Motorcycle Club, MS-13. They were defined by colors, obscure symbols graffitied on walls, some of these quite artful, and rituals that had no clear cause or limits. The most powerful entity in East Orange was the Double I Sets, a group that had been incorporated, so to speak, when a contingent of the Queen Street Bloods relocated to East Orange from Inglewood, California in the mid-1990s. With them, they'd brought some of the practices and traditions of the West Coast Bloods, most notably a merciless treatment of disloyalty within their ranks. The majority of gang-related homicides took place in public and were the result of retribution, but in Newark, far more than any other city in the nation, the gangs were intertwined with the drug trade in complicated ways. 20% of gang violence in Newark was drug-related, compared to 5% nationally. Gangs were known to cooperate with one another in order to string together and enforce distribution corridors, which ran like veins through the city. More than ever before, driving around these streets was a mortally dangerous endeavor, particularly if you were a black man in your early 20s with cornrows and tattoos, carrying cash and weed and desiring no affiliation with any group, and in fact carrying contempt, as Rob did, for those insecure enough to covet that affiliation. The standard warning to watch your back began to take on a meaning beyond the basic vigilance that a violent neighborhood necessitated. You literally had to watch your own back because a stranger might be aiming a gun or a knife at it. At Yale, Rob's initiations had entailed singing Madonna songs in the dining hall for water polo and arm-wrestling campus police for Elihu. In East Orange, initiations were completed by murdering someone, for no other reason than to prove to a tremendously cold, tremendously tight brotherhood that you possess the hardness required to watch their backs. The business of dealing drugs was liquid, transient. Connections appeared and then disappeared, usually due to prison sentences or attempts to avoid them. Rob's initial connect, the one given him by Flowey, had fallen off the grid at some point. Most likely he'd fled town to avoid conflict with a rival, police, or both. The subsequent source of his marijuana supply had come through Carl in exchange for small kickbacks. Carl was in his late 40s now, living in an apartment in Bloomfield. He insisted on being present for any transaction Rob made with his supplier, as if the man he considered his nephew might try to cheat him somehow. So Rob would drive to Carl's apartment to pick him up, drive to the supplier's house in Ivy Hill, smell the marijuana to make sure it wasn't bunk, haggle over the price per pound. Rob had negotiated $1,800, which was on the very low end, and the supplier was constantly angling to raise the figure. Rob would go through the motions of standing his ground, speaking profanely but not threateningly, while maintaining an exasperated but not derisive visage. He would act willing but not too willing to walk away, and when the arduous transaction was complete, he would drive Carl back home, leaving him with $200. Flowey, Tavris, and Drew, all of whom were in Newark, like Tavris, Drew had dropped out of college after 2 years, didn't understand why he dealt with Carl. Plenty of more stable people would eagerly help him obtain those pounds of weed. Even a minor drug on a minor level involved fronting, haggling with suppliers, canvassing for buyers, and haggling with them too, the presence one had to maintain in the neighborhood in order to keep business fluid. Rob had to be cool and laid back while also tough, imposing. These contradictions were necessary in order to keep the gap between operating costs and profit wide enough to make the risk worth it. And they didn't need to be compounded by rolling around with an unstable element such as Carl, who could be quick to take offense at real or imagined slights. "He's family," Rob would mumble when asked. "He's whack," Flowey replied. "He's my business." They figured that what Rob meant was that of all the other men he could be associating with, none of them had lived in the house on Chapman Street while he was growing up. None of them had given him rides to the Essex County Jail to visit Skeet. None of them had driven the car that took his father home from prison, that one and only time, an hour-long transit that Rob still carried with him. But still, his friends didn't get it. Rob's role as a dealer was already more complicated than the next guy's, because he was now a Yale graduate, tagged with all the many stigmata that simple word carried in this neighborhood's underworld. Like a bird handled by humans whose flock would not accept it back, Rob now wore the unwashable scent of the Ivy League. To the extent that he could, Rob kept his Yale pedigree a secret from everyone he dealt with. If his supplier were to become aware of it, he would automatically assume Rob was trying to get one over on him. And even the suspicion was dangerous. So Rob played the role of desperate, struggling paranoid, not too bright hustler once every couple weeks. And as he finally explained to his friends, he used Carl, not out of loyalty or charity, but as a beard to legitimize this image of himself, yet another Newark-proofing trick. After these pickups, he would drive the stash back to New Haven, bury it in the black trunk beneath the Python tank, and return to the high-definition screen in his lab to study the way proteins, a few molecules wide, interacted in a cancerous environment. "What's it like, still being on campus after graduating?" I asked. Rob shrugged. "Same old, I suppose. Quiet, at least." We were walking together along the western edge of campus to a bar. It was early August 2002, and I was visiting for the weekend. The campus was placid during these off months, populated mostly by faculty and graduate students. The quads and throughways and bars nicely untrafficked. I was there to visit a female friend who was about to enter the Yale Drama School as a playwright. I'd emailed Rob, and we'd arranged to grab a drink. To me, the atmosphere felt surreal in comparison to New York City, where hundreds of my classmates and I were now beginning to make our way, flinging ourselves fervently into the entropy of city life. Knowing how eager he'd been at times to get out of Yale, I was curious about the irony of him being the one who'd stayed behind. Rob had been dealing with rapid atmospheric transitions, far greater than the one I was pondering for the last 8 years. He didn't seem to worry about it in the slightest. And yet, when he spoke of Rio, which was all he really spoke of that night, I heard a craving in his voice. "When the sun goes down there," he said, "everyone along the beach stops what they're doing and claps every night." He shook his head and smiled, seeing it. I'd never known Rob to be much of a romantic, but there it was in his eyes, pure romance, not with a person, but with a place. A poetry professor had once defined romance to me as bringing two people together when every force in the universe is working to keep them apart. As Rob's still vague plan to make it there for Carnival next spring coalesced, he seemed to feel like a part of that construction. At night, before he went to bed, as he'd once done legal research on his father's behalf, he now practiced Portuguese for an hour. We had a few drinks and talked like this, ground-level information, as was our way. Then I met up with the playwright and her friends, aspiring artists all, who talked of nothing but big ideas and how they would capture their essences in prose and achieve greatness that way, or at least staff writing positions on cable TV shows. In comparison to the time I'd just spent with Rob, the rest of the night was painful in its pretension. After graduation, like many of our classmates, I'd gone home for 2 weeks to do nothing except be genially backpatted for my Yale diploma. Unlike many, I had no job lined up and no plans for graduate school. I'd made attempts with various organizations and charter schools to become an English teacher in New York City, mostly in Harlem and Brooklyn. But the veteran administrators had taken one look and known immediately that the urban kids would steamroll me. I stayed at my uncle's house in Summit, New Jersey, a base camp of sorts while I commuted into the city for job interviews, looking for something that would allow time to write books. Though I'd been to East Orange just weeks earlier for that cookout, I had no idea that the ritzy town in which I was crashing was less than a 10-minute drive from Rob's neighborhood. The New Jersey Transit line took me through Newark Penn Station each morning, but the proximity still didn't occur to me. Ultimately, I found a job writing a grant proposal for a broad life school scheme conceived by a successful corporate event producer in the city. My brother made the connection for me, as family members were often able to do in the arena of Ivy League alumni. Friends and teammates had already begun their finance jobs and were working upward of 100 hours per week as data analysts. Others were beginning academic fellowships, both here and abroad, or gearing up for law and medical schools. For those of us in New York, the city had a playground feeling of being unbound. An excitement fixed itself to negotiating dumpy sublets in the East Village, opening up social circles to include new and varied people, going to rock shows on Houston Street, and finding the best dive bars in which to talk giddily about how broke we all were and lament the $5 beers we were drinking. We strived to become authentic New Yorkers, and though we were embarking on different journeys, we clung to the idea of shared experience that buoyed us in that familiar off-to-college feeling even after college had passed us on. Rob, in his way, did the same. For the first time, he owned a cell phone. Throughout college, he'd used a beeper and exercised the device well, and he kept in close touch with everyone. Curtis was still at Morehouse on a 5-year graduation plan. Tavares was still working in real estate, and had it in his head to try to flip houses, an idea that Rob took to himself, possessing as he did the startup capital. Floey was living with LaQuisha, still lifeguarding, landscaping, and helping friends fix their cars. Drew worked in construction. Victor had moved back in with his brother in southern New Jersey, and he'd gotten a job at Home Depot to make ends meet while hoping to eventually land a job with the FAA. Ty was in Cambridge, England, on his fellowship. Danny Nelson was getting an MBA at the University of Chicago. Daniela Pierce remained in New Haven, segueing her volunteer social work into a career. And Oswaldo Gutierrez had come back to Newark, where he was living with his family in a kind of emotional chaos that all but nullified the academic and mental progress he'd made at Yale. While his family expected him to begin contributing financially, his boyhood friends were trying to figure out what to make of him. Like Rob, he felt his psyche being wracked by the relentless obligation to be of this world after the last 4 years had wholly removed him from it. In the meantime, he was 22 years old, unemployed, and in the grip of an internal maelstrom that he felt fundamentally unable to overcome. While looking for work, he helped his father's home repair business, haggling with low-income Newarkers about how much a radiator should cost with the same tricky dynamics that Rob navigated while negotiating the price of weed. "Come to Rio with me," Rob told Oswaldo. Almost all of Oswaldo's Yale friends had been advising him to just get out of Newark, get away from his family, disengage, and embark on his own life. to Rob alone, the fact that Oswaldo had to remain in his family's orbit was simply a given. Between them, Rob justified his own current living situation with the knowledge that once he returned from Rio, once he permitted himself that vacation, he would be home for good.
"I can't dip out like that," Oswaldo replied.
"Just come for a minute.
Tickets over a grand.
I'll spot you. It'll get your mind right. We'll just chill."
"No, Rob. No, can't."
"All right, then. You need some money?"
"I do, yeah, but I'm not taking any from you."
"It's all good," Rob said,
which was what he always said at some point.
"How much you need, I'll take care of it."
"I'll figure it out," Oswaldo replied.
"Always have.
You need anything, you just let me know, cool?"
"Yeah."
"You'll get through this. You're a scrawny little bitch, but you're hard, too."
And as Rob spent hours each day checking in on friends like Oswaldo, offering advice on how to achieve their short and long-term goals, he began on his own short-term goal, which was to launder the $60,000 of cash that still languished in his black trunk. One can launder money in two primary ways. The first option is to bring it above board with the IRS, hence the business fronts and transactional razzle-dazzle that tentpoles the large-scale drug trade. This venture is expensive, not just because of the overhead costs inherent to the process, but because ultimately, as is the entire point, the money becomes taxable. The second method is to do nothing, keep the money in cash, and clean the bills only by spending them slowly, such that the IRS would never figure out any discrepancy between cash earned and cash expended over the course of a year. Rob had no discernible reason not to opt for the latter. He made a livable income. Now that school expenses were over with, he barely spent any of his savings at all. In the great scheme of things, he hadn't made all that much money selling drugs to begin with, and Rob Peace wasn't exactly a prime target for an audit. And yet, for reasons unknown, Rob felt compelled to clean his money. Maybe he felt that since he didn't have any employment lined up once the lab stint ended and he returned from Rio, he needed to launder his earnings in advance, while he still had a vehicle to do so. Maybe, because he planned to give much of it to his mother, he wanted to protect her. Maybe, rather than legitimize the money, he wanted to legitimize himself and feel like he was a true player with the capacity to rig the system any way he wanted. He wanted to feel in complete control of the innately uncontrollable business in which he dealt. He used the lab where he worked, which had both university and grant funding in excess of $4 million per year. Much of the budget went toward the high-tech screening equipment and biological supplies used in their research. Just as much was used for standard lab equipment, beakers, chemicals, sterilization kits, the biochemical equivalents of toilet paper and light bulbs. Rob began buying these items in his own name and submitting the receipts to the accounting office for cash reimbursement. These figures usually fell in the neighborhood of $500 per week, but sometimes ranged up to $2,000, and 1 to 3 weeks after submitting the claim, he would receive the cash, along with the reimbursement receipt that legitimized it. Because he did this slowly, carefully, over a period of 9 months, neither the IRS nor the university accounting office ever took note. When a graduate assistant asked him why he had paid cash out of pocket, the inquiry came more out of confusion than suspicion. Why put yourself out in the time between expenditure and reimbursement when you could have signed a form charging it to the lab? Rob just shrugged and explained that there had been an account issue with the wholesaler and he'd needed to restock the equipment fast. Raquel assumed that Rob was using his job to take care of the bills he had stockpiled, most likely filtering the small cash deposits along with his paychecks like most prudent people would. Had she known of the specifics, she would have surely questioned the selfishness, arrogance, and stupidity at work. If he were to be caught and subsequently present the police with all these receipts, the next thing they would do would be to question his colleagues and superiors. The cancer research lab might be accused of shoddy financial procedures. The professor who had invested so much in Rob's education would be embarrassed by any controversy. "What the fuck?" she would have asked, braving the anger that Rob unleashed in the face of anyone questioning his intelligence, his larger plans. But here was Rob at his most elusive, and he kept his roommate in the dark. In the meantime, Raquel had fallen in love and so wasn't prone to noticing any activity in and around Rob's black trunk. Simon Rodriguez was a quiet, organized Yale graduate working at Bayer for a year before he began med school in Manhattan. Raquel was a self-described, hot mess with cornrows who had just been locked out of her apartment after working in a photo lab all day. She'd joined Rob at a friend's house where everyone told her to clean up her photo equipment before Simon came home and flipped out at the mess. When he did enter, her throat closed up and her heart began pounding, and she pulled Rob aside.
"I think I love him," she said.
"You want him? You go get him, girl," Rob replied, though to his knowledge a pairing of two more opposite personalities had never occurred in the world before. To aid her pursuit, Rob proceeded to rally the others in the apartment for a spontaneous Mohegan Sun trip, knowing that Simon would never want to go. 5 years later, Raquel and Simon would be married. On Valentine's Day of 2003, after staying in New Haven for 9 months following graduation, Rob left for Rio. He had no place to stay, no friends there, no plan. All he had was a portion of his savings set aside for these weeks, and a burning curiosity to see the place. He left most of his things at Raquel's. He left a mess, actually, along with a few ounces of marijuana hidden in jars of formaldehyde to take care of her while he was gone. The only major items he moved were Dio's tank to Chapman Street, stoking his mother's terror, and the black trunk containing his cash and drug paraphernalia, not wanting Raquel to be in danger on the off chance that police entered the apartment. This he left with Carl, heavily padlocked, with instructions to keep it hidden. Carl shrugged and told him that this was no problem and not the first time he'd been asked to look after a container of something with no questions asked, and only one order given. Presumably, the latter response was the reason Rob had chosen his father's old friend and colleague as the trunk's keeper. "You stay safe now," Jackie said in parting to her son. They were standing on the front porch by the two Adirondack chairs. She still had no idea why he was going to South America, only that he could never be talked out of it. She didn't know when he was coming back, either. The ticket was one way.
"Always," he replied.
"I hear they have people down there that cut your pocket open with a razor and your wallet just drops out and you never feel a thing. So you keep your wallet in your front pocket with your hand on it."
"Come on, Ma, I grew up in the hood."
"Okay, then, whatever you say."
"You're my heart, Ma."
Tavros dropped him off at Newark International Airport.
"When I get back," Rob told him, "we'll start looking at houses."
"We'll do it. We'll make it happen."
Tavros began counting the days.
There it was, Copacabana. The white sand rolled out on either side, and the green water before him stretched a few thousand miles to Antarctica, which at the moment sent a cool breeze north over the city. Sugarloaf Mountain thrust up sharply in the distance to his left, and the Cristo Redentor statue loomed open-armed behind and far above him. Across the water to the west, the Vidigal favelas are the Brazilian version of slums, cut into the rainforest where the densely stacked tin roofs and narrow alleyways ascended the hills, and the squalor contained therein somehow appeared gorgeous from this long angle. He stood and watched the people. Thousands of them covered the 100 yards of sand between the city and the beach. Beautiful people descended from a combination of European immigrants, Amerindian indigenous people, and enslaved Africans. All that blood and culture mixed and evolved into a city of people who seemed genetically engineered to relax and enjoy the scenery. Rob had no doubt imagined this very picture on the flight here, and the picture proved strikingly accurate as he waited, duffel bag slung over his shoulder and with no place to stay for his first Rio sunset. The orb touched down over Vidigal, and Rob found that what he'd heard was true. People did applaud. For the first time he could remember, he had nothing to do and no one to worry about. He found a room in the South Zone where the good beaches and most of the parties were. For $400 a month, less than the basement apartment in New Haven, less even than Tavros was paying for his dilapidated one-bedroom in East Orange, he had a decent-sized studio with French doors that opened directly over Ipanema Beach, rippling white curtains that parted onto a semicircle of marbled balcony perched above sand the color of pearls. He would wake up, drink coffee beachside while reading the news in Portuguese, and then walk along the ocean, sometimes for hours, past the entire length of the city. Then he would have a few drinks, also beachside and people watch, primarily the women, whose thongs he learned were famous worldwide for a reason. Then he would walk some more on the hard sand down by the water, warm waves lapping over his ankles. And the sun would arc across the sky, and at some point he would find a spot of dry sand and smoke a blunt, sharing with any passers-by who asked, knowing that this was part of the culture here. Nobody cared, they just let you be, and he would wait for sunset so that he could stand up and clap his hands with everyone else. He'd swim while it was still light enough, straight out for half a mile with his strong choppy strokes, his eyes open and pointed into the depthless green, weaving through fishing boats and yachts, until he stopped to turn around and tread water for a moment, gazing at the city from afar as the dusky light thinned and the shoreline began to glow with multicolored pinpoints of electricity, before plunging his head again into the now dark water and swimming back toward civilization. He didn't stand out for being a nerd in a pink school uniform here, as he had in East Orange. He didn't stand out for being black and wearing a Scully as he had at Yale. He didn't have to keep track of bills exiting and entering his wallet, kept in the front right pocket, as he had always. He was just a man on vacation, cutting a broad, muscular silhouette against the southern horizon as he walked along the beach. Once cleaned off, he struck out into Rio each night, on foot or by bus, to drink and smoke at whatever party looked the most pleasing in passing. And within a week, he had made friends, some tourists passing through, some transplants from America or Europe, most of them lifelong residents from all the various neighborhoods, each of which he would explore over the coming weeks. Rio was almost evenly split between Cariocas, the light-skinned descendants of European settlers, and Pardos, the brown-skinned descendants of native Brazilians and African slaves. Like Newark, the city had experienced a massive influx of rural minorities looking for industrial work during the 1950s. Like Newark, a large number of these minorities had been segregated into the favelas. Like Newark, the city had attempted to incorporate these slums into public housing projects, which, like Newark, had only exacerbated racial tensions and violence. Like Newark, the decline of the manufacturing sector had cast these outlying neighborhoods into permanent poverty that became a breeding ground for drug traffic. Unlike Newark, the various socioeconomic groups within the city intermingled fluidly in public spaces, and a person like Rob could travel almost anywhere he wanted without fear of confrontation, without having to watch his back. A friend from Yale, now on spring break from the Teach for America program, happened to be traveling through South America with his girlfriend and came to crash with Rob. The girl watched the two men ride horses along Leblon Beach, their silhouettes passing to and fro across the sunset. She'd known Rob at Yale, had been curious about him, but never intimate. The fact that almost a year after graduation found this man, whom she'd always thought to be an irritable, cynical boy from the hood, riding a horse along a South American beach, literally shouting Yahoo again and again, was mind-boggling to her. The next day, Rob took them in the cable car to the peak of Sugarloaf Mountain, where they had a view of the unique sprawl of the city, like fingers poking into the impenetrable jungle. They followed the excursion with samba dancing at a club. A week later, Curtis flew down from Atlanta. He hadn't needed much cajoling to do so. The serenity in Rob's voice that rose above the static of the international call had been sufficient. On his first day, they hiked up Corcovado, at the top of which the soapstone Cristo Redentor statue, that worldwide symbol of peace, stood 100 feet tall. The steps were covered with brightly colored mosaic tiles, a hypnotic collage of religious and cultural imagery. The tourists, constantly stopping to bend down and look more closely, created a logjam. Curtis was out of shape and trying to push his way to the top, wondering why they hadn't just taken the elevator. "Yo, Paolo!" Rob suddenly stepped out of the crowd, over the precarious railing and onto the slope, where a man who might have been 100 years old was on his hands and knees, regrouting a cluster of chipped tiles. They embraced and began speaking in rapid Portuguese. Curtis gradually gleaned that Paolo was not simply a custodial employee of the city tourism department. He'd actually built the stairs himself, with his father 60 years earlier. Now he lived with his wife in a one-room cabin near the base of the steps, and every day he worked to maintain the stairway. Later, Rob and Curtis ate dinner in that cabin, spicy stewed pork served over rice. Rob and Paolo kept a running conversation in Portuguese that Curtis couldn't understand as Rob finished bowl after bowl of stew. "What were you talking about the whole night?" Curtis asked when they left. "Nothing much," Rob replied, "just asking questions about his life." "He fixes stairs. How many questions can there be?" Rob laughed. "Over 1 million people a year walk up those stairs. And he built that shit. The man has seen a lot of things, met a lot of people." There were notes in Rob's voice that approached envy of the simplicity of it all. "Also, I needed to get that recipe." He made the recipe a few nights later for two women they had met. Kalyana and Iris. They were curvy, too much so in Curtis's estimation, but Rob thought they were just about the most beautiful women he'd ever met. He told Curtis to pick one, which girl didn't matter to him. Rob ended up sitting next to Kalyana. As he set dinner down on the table on his balcony, Kalyana noted, wide-eyed, that a man had never served her before. In Brazil, even in the modern city, the woman served the man. By the time the entree was set down, Curtis realized that these girls would probably marry them tonight if asked. And he didn't put it past Rob to ask, so entranced was his friend. Not necessarily by Kalyana herself, but by the lifestyle she represented. Both girls spoke some English, but Rob preferred to talk in their language, slowing his cadence, enjoying it when she laughed at him for flubbing a tense. Curtis, left on his own, conversed awkwardly with Iris. He hadn't seen Rob much over the last 4.5 years, just Thanksgivings and a few weeks during the summers, reunions that had thinned as the years had gone on. Observing him now, having somehow forged an existence in this city in the southern hemisphere where winter was summer, Curtis suddenly understood what the word peace meant to Rob Peace. The four of them went out that night. Rob drifted away with Kalyana, saying he'd check back in tomorrow. Curtis didn't see him for 2 days. When he did come back to the studio in Ipanema, he hadn't gotten married, but he did want Curtis to come up into the Rosina favela with him. "Nah," Curtis said, "as if we don't get enough ghetto back home. You want to drag me into the hood on my vacation? Don't think so." "It's cool, people," Rob said. "It's real, and Rosina isn't even a bad one. There are tourism buses that go up there."
"Sightseeing in the favela?" Curtis asked.
"Yeah, it's called slum tourism. Fucked up, ain't it?"
"How do you know people over there anyway?" Rob shrugged.
"I'm good at meeting people." Curtis still didn't go. He had 1 day left and wanted to spend it on the beach. Rob came home that night with Kalyana and more marijuana than even Rob could smoke during the month further he was planning to stay. Even during Carnival, which Rob was keen to spend completely stoned around the clock for a week. The quantity made Curtis wonder if Rob was dealing here, if he was selling drugs in a place and culture he didn't fully know, governed by a legal system with far fewer safety nets than even New York had. But he didn't ask, not wanting to spend his last day here in the precarious position of trying to tell Rob to be careful. Curtis had one of the best nights of his life. Carnival was 10 million people dressed in very little, dancing in the streets as misareta bands played from moving truck tops. It was a never-ending buffet of spicy food, fruity drinks, and masked faces perched on dancing bodies. It was hair, glitter, flesh, and all of it in constant motion. It was a choreographed parade of costumes, a chiaroscuro of color worthy of Kandinsky. The sheer scope of the party and the avidness with which the people, musicians, dancers, cooks, tourists, rich, poor, young, old, carioca, pardo, descended onto the streets was beyond anything Rob had ever hoped to experience. As a child, books had been his passageway into foreign, sometimes utopian worlds. Carnival wasn't just an incarnation of that passageway in reality. It was everything that lay on the other side, where the only thing that mattered was the moment, and millions of people were able to inhabit that moment with ease and predominantly with bliss. People back in the States talked about Woodstock this way, or Burning Man, or the Kentucky Derby, or Halloween in Greenwich Village, but none of them had ever been to Carnival. Rob had now, and he didn't want to go home. The plane banked through the overcast April sky, dropped through a layer of low-hanging clouds, and Newark materialized below. From the height of a few thousand feet, the city didn't appear to lie very far from the Empire State Building and the Statue of Liberty, the narrow column of Manhattan. The canvas appeared as one continuum of hyper-developed land, gray and veined with freeways. From this height, everything seemed to move slowly. His plane landed at dusk, and he trudged through Newark International with the other travelers, thousands of people setting out on or returning from trips that looked nothing like the one Rob had just completed. Chloe picked him up at the airport. By the time they cleared the terminals, night had fallen. Rob told Chloe where to take him.
"You want to stop at your ma's first?"
Rob shook his head. As they entered the oranges, he must have wondered what had happened to all the color, the human fluidity, the panoramic views that were still vivid in his mind. 10 minutes later, they parked at Carl's building. A few men loitered outside the front entrance, beneath a flickering, buzzy light. Rob asked Flowey to wait for him, just a couple minutes, and he walked past the men, inside to Carl's apartment. His uncle, by heart if not by blood, opened the door. He was edgy as he asked about Rio and why Rob had come home earlier than he'd planned. Rob didn't answer, didn't say that this edginess was the reason. Rob had sensed it in Carl's voice a few days earlier when he'd called to check in, and he'd known what it meant. He'd bought his return ticket immediately. His money was more important than a few more weeks in Rio. "You want a drink? A smoke?" Carl asked. "Just want my trunk," Rob said. Carl led him to the closet, where the black trunk was wedged in the very back and covered with clothes. Carl stood on the far side of the bedroom as Rob pulled the trunk out. He saw immediately that the lock had been pried off and sloppily reattached. During the few seconds needed to pull the trunk out of the closet, he experienced helplessness, rage, regret, and most of all, the despair of his own idiocy. Opening the trunk must have seemed like a formality because he already knew that his money was no longer inside. He did open it, and his eyes confirmed that not only his savings, but the time he'd put into earning it had vanished. 4 years worth of Metro North train rides, bulk drug transactions and shady inner-city homes, putting aside schoolwork so that a dozen kids a night could cycle through his room, the close calls and strained friendships. Vanished, too, was the year ahead that the money had been set aside to buy him, a year he'd intended to devote to Jackie. And Rob was the one who had decided to keep it in cash rather than a checking account. Rob was the one who'd needed to leave the country for so long. Rob was the one who'd left the trunk with a man capable of opening it. Rob was the one at fault here. Carl was behind him, mumbling something about debts and things being hard and his intent to pay the money back. Rob didn't listen. His clenched fists loosened, though he refused to turn and face the man. He leaned over and lifted the trunk. Because the lock was broken and the lid loose, he had to carry it upright in front of his chest using both arms. The empty pipes and bongs that remained inside, some of them ornate and carrying sentimental value for him, clattered around hollowly. At this point, he didn't care that there were men outside who were not above jumping somebody carrying a trunk like this. They could take it from him if they wanted. He must have still been hearing Carl's voice talking about the past, his needs, what he felt he was owed for his role in Rob's life. Rob's mind was most likely already inhabiting the future, precarious now, holding none of the freedom he'd promised himself. Chapter 10. "Have you seen that movie with Tom Cruise, The Firm?" Coach Ridley asked, and Rob nodded. "It's kind of like that."
"What do you mean?"
"Once you get in, it's hard to get out." Beneath the light film reference, Coach Ridley's tone was serious. Being a high school teacher anywhere involved a certain amount of wear and tear, not to mention a low salary. But being a teacher at St. Benedict's was a way of life, and a draining one. Ridley could tell that Rob was approaching the prospect of joining the St. Benedict's faculty as a stopgap more than a career, a means to float himself for a time. From a practical standpoint, Ridley felt that Rob, with his BSc from Yale, could find an employment bridge that paid better and demanded less, and that offered him more flexibility in figuring out his next step. As they spoke, Rob kept nodding and looking around his former coach's cluttered office. Textbooks, water polo trophies, loose-leaf papers of indeterminate purpose, the stuff that made up a teacher's life. And the teacher sensed the gears within his skull not turning so much as grinding noisily together. The summer of 2003 had been the most uncertain of Rob's life, with no job, no schoolwork, and suddenly, no money. Of all his evolving dreams and goals, the one constant had always centered on his mother, taking care of her, giving back what she'd given him. Now he was living in her house again, eating her food, seeing her out the door in the morning and waiting for her to come home at night. He must have felt like one of his uncles or cousins, who'd struck out on their own, failed in some way, and been forced to return home to Chapman Street. Most grad school applications had been due in the spring. He'd missed them while in Rio. He felt perhaps the most unkeeled when he visited his father in Trenton. In Brazil, he'd made mental notes of everything he was going to tell his father. The women, the favelas, Paulo's cabin, Carnival, the thong bikinis, and any other experience that might nourish the prisoner in some way. Unlike Yale, whose world was completely inaccessible to a man convicted of murder, Rio was a place that Skeet might be able to close his eyes in his prison cell and want to be, and Rob had aimed to give to his father this gift, to let them walk together along those beaches. But now he couldn't, not after what the trip had cost him. And so the tenor of their visits remained as they had been before he'd left. The Rio trip proved to be a reaffirmation of the nature of Rob's family and neighborhood, rather than the transformation of his interior that he'd intended it to be. But still, he wanted to go back. He just needed to work first. Work. He dwelled on the word and its meaning as he made his rounds that summer. Rounds that took him to Flowey's, Tavers's, Drew's, and Curtis's. All of them were working, respectively landscaping, real estate, construction, and marketing. All of them had stable living situations, girlfriends, paychecks. Rob, who had worked harder than any of them over the last 8 years, had none of these stabilities. For the first time, his friends were the ones giving him advice, hooking him up with suppliers so he could hustle a little bit, letting him crash on their couches, brainstorming job possibilities. They were carrying him, in a sense, as they collectively struggled to figure out how Rob might get by the way they were all getting by. Getting by wasn't something they'd ever thought Rob Peace might need their help doing. His rounds also took him frequently to St. Benedict's. The school was quiet during the summer, but teachers were there running tutorials to keep the students busy and safe, while the faculty prepared for the year to come. Teachers like Friar Leahy and Coach Ridley would ask him about Yale, his lab work. Rio and Rob could feel like an achiever again. His old high school remained one of the few places where that feeling was authentic. Dexter Lopina had been Rob's classmate there and on one of the three students perennial jockeying for the 4.0 GPA. After graduation, Dexter had gone to Essex County Technical Institute for a degree in computer science, their college years having coincided with the expansion of the Internet into all facets of American life. He could have gone to an Ivy League school like Rob had, but Dexter had been practical in mapping his life. He loved computers, and he'd set himself up for a career working with them, such as his current job as the head of IT at St. Benedict's. Dexter remembered high school, when he would arrive at St. Benedict's around 7:30 most mornings and find Rob asleep in one of the classrooms, power-napping between lifeguarding and morning convocation. He remembered those minutes of sleep seeming to symbolize some burden that Rob carried quietly and alone, and he sensed that burden having grown in the years since. They went out to lunch at the Burger King on the corner, where Rob grumbled about needing a job. Dexter tried and failed to find vestiges of his old classmate. Across the table in the fast food restaurant, he just saw a young man struggling. Casually, he said, "Hell, why don't you just teach at St. B's? It'd be fun." The idea wasn't as spontaneous as Dexter presented it. In fact, Friar Leahy had been thinking about this for some time. He may have even planted the notion in Dexter's head. He'd been tracking Rob closely during his various visits to the school since college graduation. Like Dexter, he'd been attuned to the weight that seemed to be bearing down on the young man, but unlike Dexter, he wasn't surprised that the former group leader and presidential award winner had run up against such a wall in his life. The situation reminded him of one of his first students, class of 74, the year the school reopened. The very bright African-American student had gone to Harvard and won a Rhodes Scholarship. Then he'd returned to Newark during one of the most accelerated spans of the city's deterioration. Overeducated and underskilled for most jobs available, he hadn't been able to find work. The man had cracked up under the pressure of living in two worlds, being surrounded by friends from a hardscrabble youth and yet set apart by his elite education. Eventually, he'd killed himself. Friar Leahy believed Rob to be far too confident and mentally sound to be driven towards suicide, but he also knew he might benefit from returning to the place where his potential had once blossomed. In August, he offered Rob a job teaching biology to freshmen and sophomores. "It could be good for a minute," Rob said almost resignedly. He and Curtis were sitting on the hood of Curtis's car, smoking a joint amid the cherry blossom groves of Branch Brook Park. He approached the decision scientifically, reducing it to pros and cons. Pros: it was barely a living wage, a place and people he knew well. He would be very good at it. The job would look decent on a resume. He'd have plenty of time off to travel and figure out his life. Cons: it was barely a living wage. The kids would annoy the hell out of him. The work would probably be more taxing than he thought. Teaching at this level wasn't what he wanted to do. "How much they pay?" Curtis asked. "$27,500. Curtis nodded. He was making $40,000 a year in an entry-level position at a marketing firm, and he saw something fundamentally wrong with the world in which Rob Peace was earning 30% less.
"You'll have fun," he said finally, "but just don't, like..."
"Don't what?" Rob asked.
"Don't get stuck there."
A dozen or so people hung out in a small living room, opened bottles of cheap liquor and dollar store juices on the coffee table, music playing, TV on, marijuana haze thick. Rob was talking to a girl on the couch, probably telling her what Rio was like. He didn't know many others at the party. He just tagged along with Tavris and Flowey near the end of the summer.
"You the dude went to Yale?"
Rob looked behind him. He'd never seen the guy before.
"Yeah," was all he said. "So what are you doing in my house?"
"What's it look like? Chilling," Rob grinned. And the guy didn't like the way the grin looked.
"Go slumming somewhere else," he said.
"I'm not leaving," Rob replied. And then,
"What?"
The room did what all rooms, whether at Yale or in East Orange, did when two men prepared to fight. It stopped, and people backed up to clear space, their faces exhibiting more excitement than concern, and Rob must have been gauging those faces, looking for familiar ones and finding none. Flowey and Tavris were in the backyard, trying to figure which ones would back his opponent and finding many.
"Come on," Rob said. "If you want to start shit for no reason, then start."
Then they were out on the front porch, arms locked together in close quarters, exchanging short jabs in order to prevent uppercuts and haymakers, calling each other bitch, motherfucker, nigger. The fight was real, one that drew blood, which as Flowey and Tavris rushed forward from the crowd, they considered the stupidest thing their friend could possibly have allowed to happen. You never knew who was carrying a gun or a blade, and even if they weren't carrying now, they probably would be tomorrow. Finding out where someone lived was easy enough to do. They broke up the fight as cleanly as they could. Flowey knew the guy and talked him down while Tavris hustled Rob onto the street toward their car.
"You can't do that," Tavris said.
Rob was breathing heavily, the muscles of his face tight and hot, rushing with blood.
"What the hell am I supposed to do?"
"Chill, walk away."
"Why?"
"Because.
What if us two aren't there?"
Rob still liked to walk around the neighborhood. He liked hanging on stoops beneath the oppressive summer heat, and he liked house parties at his friends. But he had to be careful now about what he said. For 4 years at Yale, he'd sat at the center of his circle with free rein to utter whatever was on his mind. He was well known for calling people out on their bullshit. He'd been able to exercise that tendency with the concrete awareness that his words had no consequences, not real ones. Maybe someone's feelings would get hurt. Maybe there'd be an argument. Even so, nobody at Yale would ever come at him. No one carried lethal weapons. No one constructed the particular walls around his pride that, if penetrated, might impel him to want to inflict severe physical harm. The situation was different at Newark. More so now than ever, since the gang explosion had begun. Offend the wrong person with a word or an expression, and Rob risked having a loyal militia patrolling the streets of East Orange, armed, with no compunction about putting a bullet in someone. Whenever that word, Yale, was uttered, even in the lightest way possible, Rob did what he could do to undermine its connotation. An exchange might begin with someone saying, "I still don't believe a punk ass like you went to no Yale, you're just lying." And Rob would shake his head with a doleful semi-smile and say, "Yeah, I did that shit." Then later, he would politely ask whoever had invoked the university never to do so again. He didn't need or want that Yale label on his leather jacket. Across the Hudson River in Manhattan, his former classmates were wearing the same label like a badge. We went out in groups, herding through the East Village in Soho, the way we once had through the quads of New Haven. We went to mixers at the Yale Club on Thursday nights, hobnobbing with other alumni over bowls of gourmet potato chips and heated silver trays of pigs in blankets. We had parties on walk-up rooftops and gazed at the uptown skyline, feeling like those towers had been built not for commerce alone, but also for us and our dreams. The summer before Rob began teaching at St. Benedict's, I returned from 2 months living in Tanzania, where I worked writing grant proposals for an environmental nonprofit. In small villages dotting an arc of mountain cloud forests that rose dramatically from the Maasai steppe, I'd helped people build wells with money my writing had secured. I'd hiked through a forest in northern Mozambique where cannibals were known to live. One afternoon I'd almost been trampled by an elephant, and the following evening, while urinating in an outhouse, a black mamba had slithered lazily between my feet. I'd snorkeled alone in great white-infested waters a mile from Zanzibar's shore. I'd lived in a small house built by hand on the edge of a mountaintop, and each morning a carpet of clouds condensed hundreds of feet below the front door and ascended the cliff face, passing over me in a thick mist, then giving way to a mesmerizing view of the savannah. When I returned to New York, I couldn't wait to tell Rob, tell him that I'd done something he would genuinely admire. I tried emailing his Hotmail account from the rare functional internet kiosk in Dar es Salaam, but my message had been returned by Mailer Damon, saying that the address no longer existed. The cell phone number I had didn't work either. I contacted as many mutual friends as I could think of, but no one knew how to get in touch with Rob Peace. How strange it was that, in the minds of these friends, admittedly not his closest at Yale, Rob had already become a kind of fond but removed afterthought. Oh yeah, Rob Peace. No, I haven't heard from him since college. I wonder how that dude's doing. Finally, I thought to ask my mother if that contact sheet, the one we'd received before freshman year, still existed. She found it at the bottom of a drawer in my old desk at home, and I called the house on Chapman Street. No one answered the first few times I tried, and there didn't seem to be an answering machine. I began letting go of the effort, distracted by the nonprofit work, the novel I was working on, the girls I was pining for. Not until late in the fall did our roommate Ty, now in his first year at Harvard Med School, after completing his fellowship in Cambridge, email me a cell number. "Hey, Rob," I said, and when it took him a moment to place my voice, "it's Jeff." He mumbled, "Hey, what's up, to Jeffrey? Just wanted to see how it's going." "It's going." "What are you up to?"
"Just started teaching."
"Like in grad school or?"
"Nah, high school, St. Benedict's."
"How is that?"
"It's cool. I want to kill these little shits sometimes, but it's cool."
He was in the middle of his workday and jumped off quickly before I even thought to mention Africa. I hung up and sat in my 200-square-foot studio in Little Italy. My salary from the nonprofit was a free rent-controlled apartment in the chic neighborhood, and I fell into a brief but unsettling state of melancholy. The truth was, he hadn't seemed all that interested in hearing from me, which implied that just as Rob had seemed to be fading from friends' minds, so were we from his. On a night in August 2003, not long before we'd spoken, one of Rob's bulk suppliers had pulled a gun on him after Rob had threatened to walk away in the midst of a failed negotiation. The threat was fairly standard. The gun was not. Rob didn't know if the weapon was loaded, and he later claimed to be certain that its bearer had no intention of actually pulling the trigger. But triggers did get pulled. They were pulled all the time here. They'd been pulled on former classmates from Oakdale, Mount Carmel, and St. Benedict's. They'd been pulled on friends of both his mother and father. One had been pulled on Charlene and Estella Moore. The feeling of having the barrel of a revolver trained on you at close range was a purely visceral one, he confided in Oswaldo Gutierrez just before the first day of school. All the knowledge in his brain of chemokines and crystallography, all the triumphs and disappointments of his life had been rendered worthless, and his consciousness had narrowed to a very fine point of focus, no wider than the muzzle of a .22-caliber revolver. He paid the extra couple $100 that the supplier demanded of him. Then he began his high school teaching career, and he got out of the game. The incident with the revolver, along with the loss of his savings, had provided bookends to the summer of 2003. During the months between the business of hustling had cost him more in anxiety than it had returned in cash. Dealing had been too cushy at Yale. He'd been spoiled there by classmates who came to him and would pay what he asked. In New York, driving around dangerous streets in the middle of the night to haggle over $5 and $10 with desperate men and women, the women he felt were the hardest and saddest to deal with, the work seemed to epitomize the wear and tear Wayne Ridley had mentioned in the context of teaching high school. At its foundation was the exposure to the people who lived and died by this commerce, not just the dealers and suppliers, but the users as well. Rob was self-aware enough to understand his own relationship with marijuana, which wasn't complicated to him. He knew the science behind him. He knew what it cost him. Though he was addicted to it by all definitions regarding frequency of use, he was intelligent enough to control that addiction. High-functioning, he called himself. But seeing regularly the people who had an even greater reliance on the drug, yet without the ability to understand what that reliance meant, spawned pity in him. Outwardly, this pity manifested itself as scorn. "Motherfuckers be lazy," he would say to Flowey, Tavares, and Curtis. but within his consciousness his friends believed him to feel extraordinarily sensitive toward this widespread plight on the city in which he'd grown up, and perhaps even guilty in knowing that, had he not been born with this particular brain and his particular mother, he wouldn't be any different from these people. And maybe that was why he stopped providing.